Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, what would you do with a £50,000 windfall? Exclusive research shows that a lot of us would be too nervous to invest it. Would you? Also today, could you fall into the pension inheritance tax trap? We outline how you may get caught out. And making the news this week, the government has performed a winter fuel payment U-turn. Will you get yours back? We discuss that leaked Labour tax hike plot. Simon speaks to the CEO of regulator Ofgem. And MasterCard is to pay out £100 million to millions of customers. Are you eligible? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, over the next 25 years, an estimated $5.5 trillion is expected to be passed down from one generation to the next in the so-called Great Wealth Transfer. For those who find themselves on the receiving end of significant sums of money, what will they do with it? Well, exclusive data for This Is Money by Fidelity shows a lack of risk appetite means a large chunk might be too nervous to invest this money, while others don't have a full understanding of how to invest. So, what should you do with yours? Lee Boyce, Simon Lambert. Lee, to you first. What's all this about?
You get £50,000, you just spend it all, don't you? Just like
absolutely.
Do fun things. Yeah. No. What this is all about, this is some data that Fidelity did for us. It was a survey of 1,000 UK retail investors. So it's crucial to point out here, these are investors already that are taking part in this piece of research. And they were asked what they would do with a £50,000 one-off payment. Now, I thought this was interesting because I think we all kind of daydream about what we would do with a sudden windfall. If I won £1 million on the premium bonds, I sort of mentally think, where would I put the money? Who would I give some money to? What would you do with it? And then the very rare occasions I do like a Euro Millions or Lotto or whatever, and the jackpot's £100 million. I go through this thing, I'm like, well, I give, you know, parents this much, friends this much, you know.
Yeah. But 50 is not a million though, is it?
This is where I'm getting to. I think £50,000 is a significant sum of money, and it's a significant sum of money for a lot of people. But for some people, this isn't a huge sum of money. This isn't, I wouldn't necessarily label this a life-changing sum of money, probably for our listeners and for our readers. But for others, it would be. Of course, it would be. £50,000 is a home deposit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It's all sorts of things that that could unlock all sorts of things for you in the future. But because this is kind of investors, you would think that most of the people here probably have £50,000, although we have no way of knowing this. So what they were asked, what they'd do with it. And they, of this thousand, of the £50,000, on average, people would invest 34% of that 50 grand,
okay.
So 17 grand they would dedicate to go into investing. And then 35% would go into savings instead, and then they would spend 15% or 7.5 grand. So potentially on things like a holiday or home improvements or one-off luxury goods, you know, treat themselves essentially if they got 50 grand. Now, what I thought would be quite interesting potentially is if we ask the same question again, but with £500,000, because I think you'd get a very different answer. I also think it would be interesting to know from just the general public, because I think a £50,000 one-off kind of windfall, I think the investing amount would be far lower than what's in this Fidelity research. If you ask people, you know, a representative amount of people from across the country what they would do with 50 grand, I don't think 34% of that sum would be invested. I think it would be far lower. People are a bit nervy of the risk of investing. You know, we can only say it so many times, but investing is for the long term, usually outperforms money that's parked in savings. But it's an interesting question because a lot of people will be getting sums of money handed down to them in the form of estates. You know, you said there about the Great Wealth Transfer, £5.5 trillion is likely to be passed over the next 25 years. A lot of that's come from things like house price growth. It's come from regular people investing and saving much better than they have in previous generations, and want and a kind of need to help children do better financially, their own children, and helping kind of get them on the property ladder and that kind of thing. But it can also, honestly, Georgie, be a bit of a beautiful nightmare for people, I think. You know, they get a large sum of money. Mm. I think, first of all, unless you're kind of in the finance industry, I think there's that kind of, first of all, that fear of, I want the money to be safe, as in there's so much fraud and scams around. It's kind of like you give you sleepless nights if you're given a big sum of money all of a sudden. You think, oh, my, oh, you know. And then there's that step of, and what do I do with it? I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, making the wrong decision.
Am I making the right choice? You know, and quite often there's a lot of differing around, and there's a lot of, and I say differing, but I mean, you want to take your time and think about what you're going to do with it. Now, the difference between 50K and 5K and 50K and £500,000 is a completely different ball game. It all depends on your own risk appetite and what you're willing to do with the money, and whether you've got debt, whether you've got an outstanding mortgage. There's lots of variables. But I think one of the worst things that people do is just do nothing. You know, they get the money and they just park it in a current account and just think, oh, I'll deal with this tomorrow, or I'll deal with this next week. You know, it's not going anywhere. But the more you do that, the more it's kind of just getting eroded by inflation and not keeping up with you know, you should be growing that money. So I think it's an interesting talking point. Mm. And it's an interesting talking point, I think, of a wider kind of group of people rather than just investors. I was quite surprised by the 34%. I would have thought with already people that invest, I would have thought it would have been higher. And then I would think the people that don't already invest, the figure would be far lower.
It depends what age you're at, depends what your goals are, etc. Like, little studies like this, they show a snapshot, don't they? But I think the great wealth transfer is a really interesting phenomenon. And I saw some figures, I think it was yesterday, about 52% of first-time buyers last year received help from family members. This is creating this really big divide, isn't it, between the haves and the have-nots, those that have got sort of parental or grandparental wealth and those that haven't. Simon, what did you make of this?
I think that in terms of what you would do with the money, we are now so inured to how expensive stuff is, particularly if you live in a chunk of the country where homes are, you know, £400,000-£500,000, and you're not even getting that much for your £400,000 or £500,000, that you see sums bandied around like £50,000, and you think, oh, it's not that much, is it? But actually, it's a huge sum of money. And if you were given that as a windfall out of nowhere, you know, so, and I'd like to think that, like, we're not talking an inheritance here. I'd like to think a genuine windfall. You won £50,000 on the premium bonds or the lottery or something like that. You know, what would you do with it? Like, the sensible thing to do with it, as Lee said, would be to invest it. The difference in returns between investing it and getting a 6% return, which isn't a particularly high return for investing, but it's a decent one. So if you get 6%, the difference between that and invest and saving it and getting 4%, which is better than you would have averaged over the last, you know, kind of 5 years. Over 5 years, you know, you're going to end up about £5,000 up from investing, but over, once you move to 10 years, you're going to end up about £15,000 up. And once you move beyond that, the compounding really makes a difference. But I think it's less being compartmentalized in that thinking. It's you take some of it and do one thing, and some of it and do another, and some of it and do another, which, you know, you would, you know, so for example, I might pay 25 grand off my mortgage, right? Stick some of it in investments and then go on a nice holiday, you know, use a windfall for something nice, kind of thing. When you start thinking about a windfall like that, it's easier to do it. When you start talking about the great wealth transfer that you asked me about, it's harder, because a lot of this money, if it is going to first-time buyers, that's easy because it goes to them, it goes as a deposit, it goes into the house. And as a parent or a grandparent, you think, okay, they're not going to waste that money. That money's gone towards something. I would rather they had it now and I could see them enjoying it. And you could raise questions of fairness and the haves and the have-nots. But ultimately, this is a function of high house prices, largely speaking. The people in certain parts of the country where houses are much more expensive need that assistance much more than the people in other parts of the country where houses are much cheaper. We talked about this last week about buy-to-let landlords, and this sort of buy-to-let is still pretty much thriving in the north and dead in the south. And it's down to, you know, well, the stamp duty thing, obviously. It's down to the deposit. It's like you can get into buy-to-let in the north with £10,000, £20,000. Down in the south, you might need £100,000. You know, there's a big difference. And it's the same with getting on the property ladder. The difficulty then becomes, what do you do in this great wealth transfer thing if your adult children already own a home? Or your adult grandchildren already own a home? Because there's lots of people who really hate the idea of inheritance tax. Now, the best way to avoid inheritance tax is spend more money on yourself or give it away in plenty of time so that you could take advantage of the seven-year rule. And there's going to be a lot more of this coming up due to pensions being pulled into the inheritance tax net, which is going to drag a whole chunk of people who didn't have a problem into this now. And those pensions are for people to live on and run down in retirement, theoretically. But they're thinking, okay, well, but if something happens to me, I don't want to lose 40%, or I don't want to lose 67% because I'm going to be in the double taxation thing. So actually, I want to try and give that money away. But what do you do? What do you get people to do with it? Because there's always that money concern that they might squander it. There's the unreliable partner worry as well. But like, put that to one side as for the moment. But you don't want to just pay off their mortgage, because maybe it's good for people to have a mortgage. Maybe it's good for them to have the financial discipline. Do you want to pay your 35 or 40 year old child's mortgage off so they no longer have a mortgage? That's great if they start putting all of the mortgage money into their pension or into investing for their children so their children can have the same benefit. But what if they suddenly decide to just go out and buy themselves a swanky new Range Rover on PCP payments, or all of a sudden they're nipping off on a couple of extra holidays a year, and you think, well, hang on a minute, I didn't pay off their mortgage just so they could live high on the hog. This isn't what the great wealth transfer was meant to be about. So then you start going, yeah, well, is that fair? But actually, economically speaking, that's literally the best thing that could happen, is we actually need the older generation to be giving the money now to the younger generation, and the younger generation to be spending it, because that will genuinely boost the economy. And there is a part of me that thinks some of this stuff around pensions and inheritance tax is actually a cynical move to get people to give money earlier and then get that money into the economy rather than it just sitting there untapped. And I think actually there could potentially be a bit of a boost for the economy coming from this, if this really does take off. And we're getting so many questions about this. Talk to Charles Stanley, who sponsored the podcast. They're getting so many questions about this stuff. Because if that goes into buying houses, doing extensions, doing up houses and all those other things, or even into PCP and Range Rovers, it does have an economic benefit.
Unless you have some sort of a contract, I'm afraid, if you're going to give your money away to someone, it's away. It's not yours anymore. It's for them to do with what they will, unless you stipulate. Lee, what do you reckon? Or some cynical move to get, I'd say, us young'uns. Do I count as a young'un? Yeah.
Do you count as a young'un?
Spending
George?
Money.
You've just said, yeah, you count as a young'un, do you? I think anyone under the age of of 70 now is technically a young'un. It's hard to really know, because people's behavior towards money is vastly different. You know, I mean, we all have friends and family members and people we know that are quite blasé with their spending. You know, you kind of think, well, where are you getting this money from? And they're just, you know, quite free spenders. And you get people on the flip side who are very, very much love tucking money away, love seeing savings and investing pots grow, and actually don't buy frivolous purchases and quite often go without. And then you just have everyone in the middle that does a bit of both, of course. But I don't know about a cynical ploy. All I do know is that £5.5 trillion is a huge amount of money. If that is an accurate figure to be passing through generations, I mean, that is an absolutely humongous sum. And it's got to be spent on something, hasn't it? I mean, otherwise there'll be a great wealth transfer in 50 years' time when we're passing over tens of trillions of pounds. Where does it all end?
We're going to be like the richest generation of 60-year-olds but we're going to have to all wait till we're 60 to get the money. Like, by which point you've bought your house, your kids have grown up, they've left home. Like, this is the argument for giving money away earlier. Okay. And actually, right, I've got an idea. Okay. This one's for free if you're listening, Rachel or Keir, or you, Angela, coming after our money with your memos. Thank you very much. We've got quite enough tax as it is. I talked about this just after the government came in. Basically, we need to fix this country. We have a major problem, infrastructure, you know, railways. We need to connect up the north, for example, but we don't have the money to do it. The roads, just fixing potholes, to go back to one of my pet subjects. All those things that we need to do. The problem is we can't do those things because we don't have any money. And we keep making decisions to squeeze figures into a spreadsheet rather than making good long-term decisions for the country. My suggestion was that we created some form of Build Back Britain bond or something like that.
Yeah.
Don't call it Help to Something, because I think that's more of a Tory idea, Help to This or Help to That. But give it a good name. Give it a, you know, kind of like the Great British Bond, mm-hmm, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you offer savers a decent return income, and it's almost like an annuity that they get that income over a set period for the rest of their life. You, mm-hmm, could even make it go up with inflation if you wanted. You don't have to pay them annuity style rates because they could get their money back at the end. Now, what you could do if you want to take advantage of the great wealth transfer and encourage this and tap into this huge amount of money and the concerns about inheritance tax is you could get those bonds, because the government would then ring fence that money and use the money to deliver the kind of infrastructure stuff that we need in this country, right? So instead of borrowing off the markets with gilt yields that have been going up recently, they borrow from their own people who are sitting on pots of cash. You could offer people those bonds, but you could make them have a juicy little kicker on them. Money in those bonds is inheritance tax free. So you've got your rich savers, right, with their money sitting in their pensions. They're worrying about, well, do I want to give it to the kids? What am I going to do? Will they squander it? Yeah, right, invest it in the Great British Bond instead. We pay you 4% every year for the next however many years, just like you do with a gilt. But instead of offering the 5.3% they're offering on a gilt at the moment, you offer 4%. 4% is still a decent rate. The kicker is your money you put in there, inheritance tax-free, gets to be passed on without being inheritance taxed. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. I want to stick with inheritance. You mentioned there the new changes that are coming in 2027 related to our pensions being caught up in the net. Now, inheritance tax, as we know, it used to be something that was just for the wealthiest. A lot of people are being brought in, and you've outlined why: house prices, high assets, those sorts of things. But you've actually got some more exclusive research. You've got a lot of exclusive research this week. Well done, people. This is from wealth management firm Evelyn Partners. They're showing how, for example, families who would currently have small, or in one of these cases, no inheritance tax liability, could instead, after this, face really quite hefty tax bills by 2030. So, Lee, dig into some of this research from Evelyn Partners. Before we do, the changes to the pensions being brought into inheritance tax, is that a definite? We've got 2027 earmarked. Is there no kind of consultation period or anything? That is it?
It looks very likely that this move is going to come in, but it's not been completely set in stone yet. I should point out here, this is exclusive data from Evelyn, because we went over to them and we were trying to, the idea of this story was to illustrate to people that I think inheritance tax has that kind of viewpoint that it is just for the very, very wealthiest. And you're right, you know, 4% of people roughly this affects. But when you start dragging in private pensions, unspent pension pots, it's likely to be 1 in 10. That's quite a sizable leap. And it's quite mixed messaging in my mind, because we're being told to save for our retirement. We don't know what the future of the state pension looks like. You know, people listening to this in their 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, there's been lots of talk in years gone by about the future of the state pension. So we've all been encouraged to save into private pensions far more. Auto enrollment was a big driver of that. I think we're in a generation where we're far more engaged with our pension because we have to be. You know, we don't have gold plated pensions. We are way more in control of our own kind of retirement and the ability to invest in certain things that your company might offer in terms of funds for your pension and all of that kind of thing. So there's been a real kind of drive to do this. And then we are being told that pensions are going to be considered in inheritance tax liabilities. And that's going to come in quite probably by 2027. And so what we wanted to do is kind of illustrate some of the sort of middle class families that could be basically hooked into this. Because I think Simon and I were talking about this in the office the other day, actually. There's kind of this viewpoint that it just affects sort of older, wealthier people. But there are people in their 20s, 30s and 40s with young families that are doing the right thing, that are saving hard and do want to pass on wealth because they've worked hard and have tried their best to, you know, provide for their families. And then this is the kind of thanks that you might end up getting. And basically, the Treasury is forecast to rake in £14.3 billion extra in inheritance tax between now and the 2029-2030 tax year. So we've got these hypothetical scenarios, but the scenario one here is we've got a family in their 30s. They're probably not considering inheritance tax, but you know, it is a morbid thought, but families can be left with a huge tax bill at any age if disaster strikes. So basically, if you die, you're not going to mitigate the charge. Now in your 30s, it is quite unlikely that you would have built up a pension pot big enough to be sort of, you know, reaching this threshold. But what the scenario we've got here is that in 2025, they have a home that's worth £750,000. Okay, they've got £500,000 in their pension. That's quite chunky. So I would use your imagination here and think this is someone in their late 30s who has saved very hard into their pension.
Can I just say one thing there, though? Because that came out a lot in the comments, right? But that is between two people. So it could be £250,000 each.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, still a lot of money, but yeah.
Still a lot of money. So £50,000 in ISAs, £20,000 in cash savings. So that's a total of £1.32 million, and currently that's a zero inheritance tax bill because private pensions aren't included in that. Now let's fast forward 5 years time. We're now in 2030. Home is now worth £962,000. Pension has grown to £709,000 from more contributions, from compound interest, from returns of whatever you're invested in. ISAs are now up to £64,000. Your cash savings are up to £22,000. So you're now worth, your technical kind of household wealth, net wealth is £1.7 million. All of a sudden, you've got a taxable estate of £459,000 because of the changes. And the IHT due now is £183,613. That's a pretty big leap. And it was just to illustrate, yes, there's lots of people that won't have pension pots that big, but lots of people are in their 30s as a couple saving hard into pensions. And you can see these are hypothetical scenarios, but you could see how that family in their 30s, even if it doesn't affect them in 5 years' time and it affects them in 2030, they're on the road to having a big IHT bill in the future, which they might not necessarily have had today.
Look, we have outlined these scenarios and they are wealthy people. Right, there is no doubt that these are wealthy people. However, they are middle class wealthy. They're not, you know, super loaded wealthy. You know, these are classic newspaper scenarios where we've done this. But they're the kind of person who lives in the southeast, right? So their house is worth a load of money, and it might not even be that fancy a house. They just happen to live somewhere expensive, and they've got the pension pot. But the pension pot, when you look at the PLSA living standards, if you want to have a comfortable retirement, the PLSA puts that at just over £40,000 for an individual. If you withdraw money at the industry standard 4% from your defined contribution pension pot, you need £1 million pension pot to deliver that. If you are the people who started saving in your early 20s when you started work, perhaps you were auto-enrolled, or perhaps it was before auto-enrollment, you're just doing what you were told you were going to do, and you built up these defined contribution pots and you kept going and you earned good money. Okay, you have to be earning good money to do this, but not super duper money. It is totally conceivable that people will have those size of pension pots by the time they're older. Now, what we've done in another scenario, for example, is we've done the Murrays. Okay, they're in their mid-50s, they've got grown-up children, they're wealthier than the Smiths, a more valuable home, bigger combined pension pots. So they've got £1 million house, £900,000 of which is mortgage-free, £1 million in pension pots between them, maybe, you know, they are of the generation that first went into defined contribution schemes, because a lot of people in that generation are going to have some final salary schemes. But there are people there who were like in the first wave of defined contribution, £100,000 in their ISAs, £50,000 in cash, bringing their total assets to £2.15 million. But today, inheritance tax isn't really an issue for them, because once you knock off the mortgage and you don't include the pensions in their net worth, their taxable estate is only £50,000. So if they died, they'd only have a £20,000 inheritance tax bill. That changes around, though, from the house going up in value a bit, the pensions rising in value, their ISAs going up a bit, the cash savings going up, but no like dramatic changes. 2030, they're worth £2.8 million, but their taxable estate is now £2.2 million because of that inclusion of the pensions. And then the inheritance tax that's due is £880,000. It's a big jump from a £20,000 inheritance tax bill to an £880,000 inheritance tax bill. And it illustrates how big the impact of this could be, because by moving pensions into it, chances are a couple like the Murrays are not going to be dying, you know, in 2030 if they're only in their mid-50s now. Their longevity says that they've got a lot longer to go. But if something did happen and they did both die one after the other, and that does happen, the family would go from a scenario where now they'd have a fairly negligible inheritance tax bill to an absolutely massive one. Some would say that that is totally fair and we need to raise more tax. And some would say that we should charge those people more inheritance tax, that we should have a wealth tax on those people right now. Others would say that you're dragging people in and trapping them with something that maybe shouldn't be in the inheritance tax net, because it's designed to be their fund for retirement. And is it fair that someone, you know, gets unlucky enough to die early and then their family gets absolutely hammered on that pension fund? Personally, I'm in the latter camp.
Yeah, the point, and I think you both made it there, and I won't labour it too long, but you've also, no pun intended, but, you know, we're going to speak about Angela Rayner and tax plots and all sorts. The reality is that with the threshold frozen, with asset prices continuing to go up, particularly houses, with pensions being brought in, that 4% figure, I don't think is going to stay at 4%. I mean, even 1 in 10, it could even go a lot higher than that, I imagine, in years to come. We do not know what's going to happen to, like I said, thresholds or percentages of how much you have to pay. And at the moment, it all feels a bit anything is game.
I would agree with you. And I would say that this is a reason why, you know, beyond the prosperity of the nation and actually our own prosperity, right? Individually, we could all really do with growth in this country picking up and things starting to improve, us dragging ourselves out of what has been described by Paul Johnson at the IFS as the tax and spend doom loop. It would be really good if, whether it's down to the government or anybody else or just luck, sheer dumb luck, we must be owed some sheer dumb luck, that things could really pick up and we get the growth coming in. Because if that does happen, it totally changes the economic picture and you won't need to have these things coming in. You won't need to have Angela Rayner's list of how to soak the middle classes be put in place and so on. But if it doesn't pick up, then it's only going to get worse because, unfortunately, you know, we don't have the money that we need and stuff is getting more expensive with the aging population, healthcare, and so on. And there's loads of other problems we haven't even talked about here that we need to fix, like social care. That can's just being kicked down the road. The bill for that doesn't feature anywhere in the government's thinking because they've gone, oh, we're going to have another consultation. But at some point, you know, we really need them to sort that out. And when they say we're going to sort that out, it's going to come with an X billion pounds a year cost and we're going to need the money. So, like, ideal scenario is things pick up, because if they don't, I would agree with you, that 4% figure is going to change. That 10% inheritance tax figure, I would say you're right, is definitely going to change as well. I would say that, like, looking at us, not if the direction of travel doesn't change, by the time we get to that age, you're going to be looking at like a fifth or a third of people being hit by inheritance tax.
All right, let's leave this to one side. Bit of better news, maybe. Millions of people could receive compensation from MasterCard. Now, this comes after a tribunal approved a settlement in a landmark lawsuit, which has been rumbling on for nearly a decade. MasterCard is set to pay out £100 million to 46 million shoppers, which, Lee, my maths isn't great, but that doesn't sound like it's going to divide into that many. But either way, let's people might remember this and think, God, I remember this going, but it's been rumbling on for, what, since 2016?
Oh, Georgie, this story does my head in. It's been going on. It's been rumbling on for absolutely ages. We're talking almost 10 years. I mean, it's like 10 years of my life that I could just done without this MasterCard story rumbling in and showing its ugly head every sort of 6 months or so. So this is a legal case that was put forward by a former financial ombudsman. His name's Walter Merricks in 2016. He argued that shoppers had paid higher prices between 1992 and 2008 due to higher card transaction fees. These were then paid by retailers and then passed on to shoppers, and these fees were later declared unlawful. What quite often happened in the past is that you could, if you were a massive company, you know, your Tesco's and whatnot, you could haggle down a much lower price per card payment compared to little Mrs. Miggins news agents around the corner. It was a kind of well-known thing that was going on, all these interchange fees and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, the litigation, Mr. Merricks argued that it should have been around about 10 to 15 billion pounds. So this got reported on lots by financial journalists because that's a lot of money. You know, MasterCard would have been absolutely hit by that kind of money. But then we found out, I'm going to say 6 months ago, it could have been 6 months ago, it could have been a year ago, it could have been 2 years ago. This is how much this MasterCard story has kind of started to wash over me a bit. That the final compensation payout was going to be far lower. And actually, it's going to be about £200 million. And £100 million of that has been ring-fenced for shoppers. The rest is expected to go to the company that funded the lawsuit. And to the Access to Justice Foundation. Once you've boiled all that down, you're not going to be getting much paid out of this. The long and short of it is, if you want to claim compensation, you'll have until the end of the year to do this. There's going to be more details about how to do this, but you'll be able to register and receive a payout by completing an online form. You don't even need to prove, by the sounds of it, from what we've heard here, that you even owned a MasterCard between those years, because of the higher prices just overall, it nobbled competition. They're saying here, if the expected 5% of claimants, 2.5 million people, came forward, and each would receive £45. If fewer people apply, obviously payments will be a bit higher, but it's going to be capped at £70 per claimant. I think it will just be one of those things where just a load of people are going to pile in and just try and get their payment. I mean, who wouldn't turn down a free 45 quid if you happen to been alive between 1992 and 2008 and bought something from a shop? I'm going to make a claim. I want a slice of this pie. I might as well try and get a free 45 quid, mightn't I? So this is what I mean. It's got very convoluted, and it's gone a bit wild, I think, from where it started. But if you get everyone in your household to go for it, you know, you probably get enough compensation for a nice put towards Christmas. I don't know when this is going to get paid out. We'll probably another couple of years of it going somewhere or other, and there being another like challenge or something. And then by that point, I'm well and truly digging a hole in the garden and burying this MasterCard story in there.
I was going to say, Lee, I'm feeling it. I'm feeling how enthused you are about this.
The funny thing is, there are stories like this that just keep coming around, but there's been two of them in a week. So we've had the MasterCard one, and the other story we've had is the age-old budget airlines to bring in standing seats story. That comes round every couple of years at least, and we've had a burst of that this week. There was some company has sort of done an AI-generated image of what the standing seats could look like, and it's been all over the place. I've seen it all over the internet. It's done great, like huge traffic. Everybody always reads that story whenever it comes out, even though they like there can't be anyone who hasn't read it before. But I did read something a few years ago that said, although this story rolls around every so often, never going to happen. It's some safety regulations basically just mean that you couldn't do it.
That's it for part one.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
Welcome back. The government has U-turned on its scrapping of winter fuel payments for most pensioners, but left everyone hanging on how and when it intends to implement this plan. More pensioners will be eligible for the payments, with the threshold being lowered as the economy improves. That's according to the Prime Minister. But details will be revealed at a future fiscal event. Simon, are we any clearer? What's going on?
It's like standing seats on an airline, isn't it? Or MasterCard payouts. The story that just won't go away. Winter fuel payments. Just when you thought it had gone away, the government decided to bring it back up again. It's like they are greatest hits. Here you go. Let's talk about winter fuel payments again. Despite the fact that the weather is warmer and has been considerably warmer over the last few weeks, although quite chilly at night time, I've been finding, the winter fuel payment is still an issue. The problem is that the government took the option of cutting winter fuel payments without really paving the way for it. The sensible thing to do would have been to try to pave the way for this. They rushed it in. God knows why they did that. Absolutely mystified. I think it was this idea of kitchen sinking, getting the bad stuff out the way early. And I don't think that that has been a strategy that's paid off, whether it's winter fuel payments or £22 billion black holes. But they rushed it and they decided to tie it in with pension credit, right? So basically it's means tested. It's worth up to £300 a year. And to qualify, you now need to claim pension credit. But they set the bar too high. So there's lots of people who do need the help who aren't getting the help. The problem with setting the bar somewhere else is like, how do you do it? What do you do? What kind of means test do you bring in? Lots of pieces of research have been done into means testing universal benefits. And the problem is that you can spend so much money and time means testing the benefit and coming up with, well, what do you do in this edge case? What do you do in that edge case? That you start to not actually get any benefit from not just giving people the benefit. Now, in this instance, obviously winter fuel is £300 a year and it's given to a lot of people. So you can cut that back. But they probably would have been better off doing something like taxing it. That would have got some of the money back. Saying that it doesn't go to higher rate taxpayers anymore. I wouldn't recommend bringing in the same thing they've got for child benefit because that's completely bonkers. But you could have done a different bar. The difficulty is, are you then going to be forcing pensioners to do a tax return? Although we're not that far off at due to the pension rising and the tax threshold staying the same. So they chose this pension credit level and it's too difficult. It's too difficult for people who still need the money. And £300 to people who really need that money makes a big difference. For some people, it is the difference between putting the heating on and being cold. And that has been the whole problem with this. So they've talked about changing it, but they've not said how they're going to change it or when they're going to change it or who's going to get it or who isn't going to get it. So it'll rumble on.
Lee, shaking your head there.
I don't know why announce this, but not announce what the detail is on it. It irks me.
Why now? When it's warm, energy bills have dropped. Like what?
Yeah. Why now? We're coming into summer, you know. It's just, I don't get the logic of it. Just make a decision and stick with it. Listen, the winter fuel payments, for some people, they just didn't need it and they were needlessly getting it. For others, it is an absolute lifeline, as Simon says. And unfortunately, some people that probably still deserve to get it have fallen away and for whatever reason don't qualify for pension credit, which is now what is required in order to get it. There's been some suggestions from our columnist, Steve Webb. So Steve Webb, who's partner of LCP, he said a couple of options that they could potentially take is reinstate winter fuel payments but make them taxable like state pensions, meaning the wealthiest pensioners would pay back up to 45% of the cash. Pay winter fuel payments in full only to people in lower value properties such as council tax bands A to D, and make payments only to older pensioners who are more likely to feel the cold and be spending a larger part of their day at home. Ooh, pretty solid suggestions. I don't know what road the government is going to sort of go down, but it's just, it's another thing that irks me, Georgie. Just tell us what the plan is. What's the plan? Just tell us what it is, not like announce it at a future, I'm going to reveal it at a future fiscal event. It's like, just like, what is it?
Yeah.
What is it?
Couldn't agree with you more, Lee. But the reality is, Simon, they themselves may not know. And this is heading to an area which you mentioned a little bit earlier with the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner. There's been a lot of talk this week about a plot, a Labour plot, to impose even more tax hikes on us, with pensions, inheritance, shares, high earners, all in the firing line. Now, this is leaked proposals that show that the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, would rather squeeze us that little bit more instead of cutting spending and benefits. Now, the memo was sent to the Chancellor before the spring statement. It suggested 8 different tax rises that would raise billions of pounds in revenue. We didn't get them in the spring. Will we get them in the autumn with the budget?
It's the stuff that just won't go away podcast, isn't it? Just when you thought you were safe from tax rises, or at least safe from stories talking about tax rises for a couple of months, because we've only just had the budget in which Rachel Reeves sensibly decided not to put any more taxes up because she'd upset so many people after her autumn budget. And we know there's probably some more bad news coming in the autumn budget, but everyone's sitting there with their toes and their fingers crossed, desperately hoping, as I said, for some growth to come in so that we don't have to have taxes go up again. Because broadly speaking, a lot of people are in agreement that just raising taxes on the same chunk of the population is probably not the best idea, because they're already quite high on a certain chunk of the population, but actually quite low on low to middle earners, which is actually down to the Tories, who reduced the tax burden on low and middle earners and raised it on higher earners and the wealthy. So, which, you know, is an interesting move for a Tory government, but they were quite a sort of Labour Tory government when it came to tax stuff. Just when you thought you were safe to go back in the water, up pops Angela Rayner's memo. In which, yeah, she outlined all of the fun police are back. She outlined all the ways that we should be raising taxes on people, some of which are sort of almost just going back to certain things. But, you know, capital gains tax, we need to raise more money in capital gains tax. Pension lifetime allowance, she'd like to bring that back, £1 million pension lifetime allowance. Again, bad policy. It was got rid of for a reason.
Yeah, remember why, exactly. Remember why they got rid of it. Stop consultants leaving the NHS was one of the main reasons.
And also bear in mind that it was the Tories that reduced it to £1 million. When Labour left office, it was £1.8 million. And the talk was that, you know, when initially Labour were talking about bringing back the lifetime allowance, which was their first reaction to the removal of it, the question was, well, what are they going to bring it back at? A million? A higher number? 1.8? Because if it had risen with inflation since it was brought in by Gordon Brown, it would have been way higher. Instead, it was pulled down. Again, freezing the threshold at which the additional rate of income tax kicks in. So that's fixed at £125,140 until April 2028. But she recommended continuing the freeze, dragging more people into the top tax band over time. The problem with this is that threshold used to be £150,000. Until Jeremy Hunt decided to lower it in his wisdom to £125,140. And if that threshold had risen with inflation from the £150,000 it was brought in at, it would be way higher now. And in fact, there's a bigger problem, which is the £100,000 60% tax trap underneath it, where the personal allowance is removed from people, which, if that had risen with inflation since it was brought in, it would be over £150,000 now. Ending inheritance tax relief on shares in firms on the alternative investment market, that's already been reined in a bit, and various other things. But this is, as you said, an insight into some of the stuff that might happen if things don't get better. And this is why we need things to get better, because all of the things in this memo, fair enough, they are directed at taxing wealthier people, but they are a step backwards. We need to get out of this incredibly complicated tax system that we've got, where there is a cottage industry in people trying to earn less money so they don't get caught out by these traps. And the people who are involved in trying to earn less money are some of the most productive, high-value people in the economy. And it's not good for anybody in the UK to have that happening. Lower earners in the UK need those people to not be deliberately trying to avoid doing work in order to earn less money, because the more work those people do, the more money and tax there is coming in, and the more it benefits everybody. And again, to point out Paul Johnson, for example, of the IFS, has said that what we need to do is really we need to expand the tax base more, and we need to we actually probably need to raise the basic rate of income tax, not higher rates on people further up the scale. But that's a very unpalatable thing to do, and it'd be very, very difficult for the Labour Party to do. But, I mean, what they should have done is they should never have promised not to raise national insurance, income tax and everything else like that, because they've backed themselves into a corner. And they should have just reversed the Tory national insurance cut on workers, at least the second one. We definitely didn't need the second one, even if they didn't reverse the first one. But now we find ourselves in this difficult position of trying to do these things. And actually, all of the measures in here wouldn't even raise that much money. The negative impact of them would, I think, outweigh the actual amount of money they'd raise.
The annoying thing with all of this, and I say this as a person who's trying to sort out their own personal finances, but as a personal finance journalist who's trying to help other people sort out their personal finances, there is nothing more frustrating than the inconsistency. You save in a certain way, you have some expectations. Yes, lots of people won't reach the lifetime allowance, but it's just another bit of tinkering around something related to our pensions that makes government figures look like they don't know what they're doing. And it makes us feel very insecure about what's coming down the line. I just think a little bit of consistency, and it's not that I don't have sympathy for the fact that we need a bit of money as the government, but they keep talking about growth and at the same time hammering people with taxes. And it sort of doesn't really add up to me. And I just wish for a little bit of stability. You know, Simon, I think we've had a lot of overexcitement in the world in the last 10 years or so, and it would be nice just to have a little bit of boring. Bring boring back. That's what I say. Make Britain boring again.
We thought that was what was going to happen, though. That, I think, I'm pretty sure Keir Starmer got elected on the boring ticket.
He got elected on the we're not them ticket.
Yeah, he definitely got elected on the boring but competent ticket. There was definitely a lot of people voted for that, and a lot of people were right to vote for that. I didn't vote for him, but I was of the view that it would be an improvement. I want them to do well. I want the country to do well. And they're in a really difficult position, okay, economically. But I think the problem is we've continued down the same path that we were going down. And what we actually need to do is go down a different path. And we need to be a bit more radical. And potentially we could have done that. The best time to do that is a change of government. I think if we hadn't have done the £22 billion black hole thing, we probably could have got away with doing it. But we need to shift away from what you said. I think what we're running is like a budget airline tax system. In theory, you've got like a cheap headline price on your airfare, but then like you're paying a lot of money for the extra stuff. They're catching you out elsewhere. Or it's like hiring a car. It's that kind of thing. I think it just needs to be more like buying a quality product where you don't get caught out.
Yeah, absolutely right, Simon. Absolutely right. Meanwhile, we got the latest energy price cap figures from Ofgem for July. Simon, you spoke to the regulator, didn't you?
I spoke to Tim Jarvis, the Director General of Markets, this morning, just after the price cap news had come out. And he talked me through what's going on, why it's gone down a bit, but also why it's still so high, you know, a good few years after the energy price spike.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say to you.
Although the price cap has come down and forecasters are suggesting that, you know, could continue, energy prices still remain far higher than they were before the energy price spike. What is it that is keeping costs so high for consumers?
Yes, you're right, Simon. I mean, they are still high. They're about 10% higher than they were this time last year, and they're still significantly higher than they were before the crisis. I mean, the primary reason for that is this price of gas, the international price of gas. We are particularly exposed to that in the UK compared to some of our international competitors. And that's why it's so important we move away from gas and move on to other sources of energy that will be much more stable and will be domestically generated.
There's a suggestion in some quarters that the cost of moving from gas to those renewable sources of energy is expensive, and that's what's driving up prices. But do you see a scenario where, you know, we could just go, oh, well, we'll just stick with what we've got and we won't worry about it? Is this something that we have to do?
I think the challenge is that if we don't do this, we're almost gambling on what the price of gas will do. Now, we've benefited for many years in this country from cheap gas. But we also had a very big shock, as we all know, in 2022, following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, where we saw prices just rocket and the government of the day spent over £40 million trying to insulate the impacts of that on households and businesses. So it's a big, big risk to do nothing, I think. And I think it's important that we move off that gas reliance onto something that is a bit that is much more stable and we can plan for.
Moving back on to the costs that, you know, households and you and I face in our energy bills every month, would Ofgem have expected prices to have fallen by more by this point, you know, after that energy price spike? When you looked at that, did you think, okay, well, I mean, what are we now, like 3 years in, that they would have come down by more for people?
I think it's hard to understate the scale of the shock to the European energy system as a result of what happened in Russia, Ukraine. You saw one of the main sources of supply of energy cut off almost overnight. So in some ways, I'm not surprised it's taking the markets a long time to adjust. I mean, it does look as though things are starting to stabilise a little bit. But as I said earlier, it isn't really in our control. So we are reliant on it. I think the long term plan has to be moving on to different forms of energy. And what we're doing in Ofgem is trying to make sure that we can support consumers through that transition, drive the cost down where we can, and support those who are struggling the most with their bills as far as we can within our remit.
And the price cap was introduced as a backstop to help people not be hugely overcharged who weren't switching their bills. And it obviously then became an essential protection for people through that energy price spike, as well as the help that the government at the time put in place. You can now switch your energy deals and you can get better prices than the price cap, but there's still an awful lot of people sitting on these price cap tariffs, isn't there? Do you think more people should be considering switching their bills to a fixed rate deal?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think we're seeing more and more people going on to fixed rate deals. We've now got over a third of customers, I think, now on fixed rate deals. So, and that number is going up. And I would just reiterate the point you made. This is a cap. You don't have to pay the cap. And there are prices out there that are cheaper, often considerably cheaper. So I would really urge people to contact their energy supplier, find out what they've got available that might well be significantly cheaper than the cap, and look at it. And if you see better deals elsewhere and they work for you, then look at switching. I think more and more people are doing that. It is probably the best and quickest way to save money.
Tim, thank you very much.
That was Tim Jarvis, Director General of Markets at Ofgem, speaking to our Simon there. Right, Simon, to wrap up, your stat of the week.
Now, you'll see what I've done here, listeners. My stat of the week, EasyJet, budget airline, revealed some figures this week. It raked in almost £1 billion from charging customers for extras in just 6 months. £978 million from charging for things like baggage, choosing your seat, speedy boarding, food, all those other things.
Wow.
Budget airline tax system.
What's that, a percentage of how much they earn in that? It's not a flying service, is it? It's an everything else service that happens to take you by plane to wherever you want to go.
Well, to put that in context, total revenue was 3.5 billion. So you're looking at, you know, slightly less than a third.
Wow, that is a stat.
Yeah, it's just a lot.
Good stat, Simon. I like that. Thank you. Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or you can download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Send us your questions. We will endeavour to answer them, or just tell us anything else that you want to tell us. You can also come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you will find all podcasts past, and you can join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.